The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I have a fantastic guest who's going to be on just in a few minutes. I just hope that satisfaction comes from appreciating what we already have and not what we're seeking more of. Hope that plays out. I hope 18 days Santa will be here to help us out. We are going to talk about one of the most common issues in living a long time in the United States of America and generally the world. Quote, a heart attack carol, atherosclerosis, past, present, and future. I have a fantastic guest, a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania pre-medical program and graduate of the Wharton Business Program. He left a research position 24 years ago and basically focused his practice on lipids and atherosclerosis. You can't get an individual who is better aware, up to date, follows up things like inflammation, cholesterol, et cetera. And I can't wait to introduce Peter Bentivagna, who is going to be with us for the next 60 minutes. Pete, welcome to Inside Medicine. And just to start off, I love your opening, a heart attack carol, atherosclerosis, past, present, and future. So can you just give us a brief cause of the mechanisms of the heart disease and cardiovascular risk?
So good morning, Dr. Fallon. It's always wonderful to speak with you, whether on the radio or off. And so, yeah, we had talked back in the spring a little bit about some of the basics about atherosclerosis and its treatments and what would really be good for us today. We're going to, as the title says, we're going to talk about what's been in the past in terms of the disease state of atherosclerosis, what's current, and then what's to come. What are some of the things we can look forward to? And like you said, there's satisfaction to be had with all the great steps that have been made already in treating atherosclerosis, and yet there's still going to be some more really good things to come. So to get started with your request there, so some of the causes of atherosclerosis and the mechanisms of heart disease and of cardiovascular risk, one thing we have to understand about atherosclerosis in general is that it's a disease of energy metabolism. So in other words, our body needs energy and our cells need energy to perform functions. And for the most part, it comes in two forms. It's either going to be energy in the form of fat or energy in the form of sugar. And so if our body has a hard time metabolizing sugar, that disease state is called diabetes. And if the body has a hard time metabolizing fats or processing fats, that ends up being the disease we call atherosclerosis. And that's where we're going to focus today. Essentially, our body's energy, whether it is fat or sugar, comes from the sun, ultimately, in that the sun is what essentially enables microorganisms, plants, algae, and so forth to grow. That's eaten by small organisms, eaten by larger and larger organisms, ultimately eaten by humans. So in effect, we're really eating the sun. And these days when the diet industry talks about nutrition and foods and diets, they often talk about energy transfer more than actual food or nutrient transfer. So with atherosclerosis, well, again, as a review, what is it and what causes it? So it's essentially a disease state, usually over time, where these fat and fat-carrying particles and cholesterol-carrying particles, they start to build up these cholesterol deposits in the arteries of our cardiovascular system. And we actually have it really since birth. I mean, there have been studies that show even before we're born, we have atherosclerotic streaks starting to form from cholesterol deposits. And it builds over time. And ultimately, the cholesterol, which is sort of like a waxy, it's like a soft candle wax almost, but as it builds up in our arteries, if it gets to be too large, and more importantly, if it gets to be too unstable, it can block the blood flow that goes through that blood vessel, and that's when we end up having a heart attack or stroke or dying. And that lump that blocks the vessel is called a thrombus, and it's generally built again by this large bolus of cholesterol, but there are other contributors to that. There's proteins and red blood cells and other things that form in there. So essentially, the disease of atherosclerosis is the building of these atherosclerotic cholesterol-laden plaques. The second aspect of it is that when that plaque builds, it can rupture. And what generally causes it to rupture and spill into the blood vessel is what's called inflammation. Inflammation is basically the body's response, usually to a foreign agent like a bacteria or a virus, but it's essentially the body's response to anything abnormal in either the cell or the tissue or the organ. And so as the blood vessels, the arteries, the linings of the arteries get what's damaged or what's called insulted, but as they suffer damage, they become inflamed. The body's essentially trying to repair the damage that is done, but that can sometimes lead to the damage increasing and rupturing. And so we have cholesterol buildup, we have inflammation, and then the third part of a thrombotic atherosclerotic, again, heart attack or stroke or death, is clotting. When there is a rupture of a plaque and it spills into the blood vessel, there's a breaking of the lining of the artery. Just like when we cut our arm or our finger or our leg on a sharp piece of metal or something, the body sends clotting agents, platelets and other clotting factors to stop the bleeding. And so internally too, when there's a break in the artery and there's a spill of cholesterol, the body will send clotting agents to that area. And if that happens to be in an artery that supplies the heart, well, we now have what's called a heart attack. Or if it's in the brain, it's a stroke. And if it's large enough and severe enough, and if it cuts off the blood flow to the tissue below that area where the thrombus has occurred, then that part of the heart or brain does not get blood flow, it does not get oxygen, and that tissue can very quickly die, and that's what's called a heart attack or stroke. So in basic summary...
Can I just ask you to hold on a second? So my picture of the whole deal is you have these fantastic arteries, and the problem is over time what you're saying is there's a buildup of plaque, which can include gruel, can include fat, and what happens is if someone gets, say, hypertension that's not controlled, or some stress, acute stress, what can happen is that pressure that increases up from the blood pressure will then break the plaque, and then gruel will come out, and the patient will try and cover that all up to repair. But in the meantime, if they break enough plaque and there's such a disease, then what's going to happen is those people will get a heart attack or lose a leg from decreased blood flow. So the arteries are very, these pressures are coming out like at over 100 millimeters of mercury. And if they break that, then the patient would have an acute stroke or an acute MI. How does that sound for an explanation? Because that artery has plaques in it, and generally that plaque top is solid, but if it gets inflammation, it can break. So is that how you would describe for the audience a heart attack or a stroke?
Yep, that's a great picture to paint. And ironically, the word you mentioned, what we ultimately would hope would happen is to harden it. We used to call it hardening of the arteries decades ago. But one of the things that helps to stabilize the plaque is to harden it. And there are therapies we'll talk about today that can help stabilize the plaque to prevent exactly what you're saying. Maybe the stress of hypertension, inflammation, diabetes, smoking, these other factors that could cause that situation, we can modify those in some of the ways we'll talk about today.
Fantastic. So are we eating the sun?
Yes. Ultimately, that is effectively what we do. If we stop and think about it, our cells, our tissues, our organs are able to move and function because of energy. Well, okay, where does that energy come from? Well, the food we eat. Well, okay, but if I pick up a carrot or a hamburger, it's not burning in my hand. It's not, it's not energy and lightning or electricity in my hand. So how is that energy? So ultimately, it's transferring the energy of the sun to a plant or a microorganism that, again, collectively is eaten by larger and larger and larger organisms, ultimately eaten by us. So yes, we are eating the sun, in effect. It's very important.
So one last thing, Pete. I'm sure I'm going to have something else in the future, but what is MACE, M-A-C-E?
So that's a great and very important part. So the acronym MACE stands for Major Adverse Cardiovascular Event, M-A-C-E, Major Adverse Cardiovascular Event. And that is a collective term for things such as death, myocardial infarction or heart attack, stroke, sudden cardiac arrest, embolism, any sort of major event involving the heart or the cardiovascular system is a MACE event. And so it's just quickly phrased and termed as MACE to summarize all the possible events that can occur.
Okay, so is there more than one type of heart disease? Does everybody have the same type of heart disease, or is it multifocal?
Yeah, so it's multifocal. That's a wonderful question to look at. So there are various kinds of events that can occur, and the heart is one part of the cardiovascular system. The arteries and veins are another part. And so there can be diseases that occur specific to the heart itself. There can be diseases that occur to the vasculature. There can be diseases that usually occur to both. So there are things such as atherosclerosis, heart failure, arrhythmias such as atrial fibrillation and ventricular aortic tachycardias. So there are various forms of heart and vascular disease. What we're going to be focusing today, though, is just primarily on atherosclerotic and thrombotic heart disease.
Okay. Can you explain what thrombosis is?
So thrombosis is actually that, as you mentioned, the gruel. It's that rupturing of a previously built plaque or lining of the artery that instead of staying either smooth or stabilized or hard, it may be soft, it may be unstable, and it's almost like a blistering of the artery where the blister ruptures and out spills into, it's kind of like if you have a big pileup of trash on the side of the street and then the barrier holding it off the street were to break and all that trash were to spill out onto the road. That's kind of what happens in a thrombotic event, and that trash that spills onto the road is what we would call the thrombus. Now, in a cardiovascular setting, that quote-unquote trash that I'm talking about, again, is built up of cholesterol and smooth muscle cells and red blood cells and platelets and other things, proteins. But the problem is that once that spills out into the artery, it starts to, just like trash would block traffic and slow down traffic, in the case of our arteries, that thrombus, that pile, that gruel, that mix of cholesterol and proteins and red blood cells, et cetera, blocks blood from flowing to all the areas below it where it's supposed to be carrying oxygen and nutrients. And so those cells and tissues and organs below there start to essentially suffocate. They can very rapidly, depending on the magnitude of the blockage, lose oxygen, which is really the most important part. And that's, again, if that occurs in the heart, that's called a heart attack. And if that occurs in the brain, it's called a stroke. If it's severe enough, it can cause death.
So, Pete, let me just throw one thing in. So we had a neighbor who had an acute cardiac event. She was having chest pains. She called 911. They came, and the answer was that the hospital, the main cardiac hospital near her house, was overflowing. And what happened is the paramedics came, saw it was an acute heart attack, and they, you know, bypassed the hospital that was filled up and got her to the proper cardiac place. And what they did is they put a stent in, which opened up that block, and she's here today, thank God. And it's interesting how the system works. There's many players in this, but when you can get somebody who can direct the person to the right place right away when time is of the essence, that heart attack got fixed and she's perking and popping today. So I like that concept of you talking about the gruel, so that somebody can go in and pop that open. And that's why a lot of people don't want to wait around if they get significant symptoms of a heart attack. Anyway, sorry I broke that up. So keep talking about the healthy heart and how it works.
Right, and the quick term for what you've described there is that time is tissue. The quicker you can get somebody experiencing symptoms to get proper care and open up that blood vessel, essentially get the trash off the street so traffic can start flowing again, the less damage there is to the tissues and organs downstream from there. That's very critical. And those stents are exactly what they do. It forces open the vessel. So with a healthy heart, the heart is actually a pretty tough muscle. And it pumps blood to all cells of the body to deliver food and oxygen and also to remove cellular waste. The arteries themselves, and we don't often think about it in this term, but the arteries themselves are actually muscles as well. It's smooth muscle, and that helps in conjunction with the heart to help pump the blood to all the cells. Veins are smooth muscle. They actually help return the blood from the cells and the cellular waste and the cellular gases back to the heart and lungs. And that cycle of things, pumping blood to cells and then back from the cells to the heart and lungs, is essentially what keeps us as an organism alive and moving. And any interruption in that starts to become disease conditions that can result in damage to any number of parts of the body. So very important to keep the heart and the blood vessels healthy, strong, and properly functioning.
So Pete, let me ask you a question. What is atherosclerosis, and what's the mechanism that causes so much potential disease and disease itself?
Right. So what we're going to really talk about as the three main villains or three main mechanisms in atherosclerosis, and therefore in MACE events, in adverse cardiovascular events, are, again, number one, the cholesterol. Excuse me. The cholesterol that builds those plaques and is really sort of the core of that gruel and of the thrombus. Secondly, the inflammation that ruptures. Sort of inflammation can be thought about. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Can be thought about as the pin that pops the balloon. What something has to cause that trash to spill on the highway. What breaks the barrier? It's inflammation. There's various forms. And you mentioned one of them, hypertension. There's others. There's smoking. There's stress. There's disease, viruses, other things. And then the third part is the body in its response sends a clot. It's like think of a ball of sticky chewing gum, and that slides down into your blood vessels, and ultimately it's there to try and patch up and cover up the break that's there. So again, like if you cut your arm or you cut your hand, the body sends clotting agents to stop the blood from flowing out of the tissue. But when that's internal and that sticky clot is stuck in a blood vessel supplying the heart or the brain, that's when we start to have a MACE event. We have a heart attack or stroke because parts of the heart or parts of the brain are not getting oxygen now. And those cells that aren't getting oxygen, basically they'll suffocate and they'll stop functioning. And that's a heart attack or a stroke is death of tissue. It's necrosis, is another term for death. When parts of the brain or parts of the heart start to die from lack of oxygen, that's an infarct called either a myocardial or heart attack or a cerebral infarct, which is a stroke. The accumulation of cholesterol. So one thing about cholesterol, it has no calories. And by that, I mean it doesn't really break down. It's kind of like asbestos. Once it's in our body, our cells can't break it down to little carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and use it as something else. So once cholesterol is in our body, we either have to use it or remove it. We can't really destroy or burn it. And that's kind of the problem with it. Most of it is used to make bile or bile salts and hormones, and that's fine. But if we have excess cholesterol, the body has to do something with it and often just ends up floating around our bloodstream till it lands in a plaque in the arteries, and that part is not good. Some of it is made by the body. Some of it's taken in through our diet. Most of it is made by the body, actually. Where it's most dangerous is after a meal, what we call the postprandial state. Just like having, again, using the analogy of traffic on the highway. Traffic is worse during rush hours, right? Like 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Same thing in the body and in the cardiovascular system. Cholesterol is most dangerous and really most atherosclerotic after a meal. We have this huge bolus of food that comes into our gut, our intestines and gastrointestinal tract extract the nutrients, but also extracts fat and cholesterol in these large amounts. And when that happens, the liver can't clear it all out in a timely fashion. And so some of it ends up residing in the bloodstream. And over time, it, instead of getting used or removed, it just lands in the blood vessels. So that's where cholesterol builds up, primarily after our meals. It's helpful. You had mentioned before about eating the sun. There are better diets for preventing atherosclerosis than the typical diet. You know, things like the Mediterranean diet, plant-based diet, these are all helpful ways to reduce the risk of cholesterol building into atherosclerosis. And it also helps reduce inflammation. And you and I are big, Dr. Fong, you and I have talked a lot about inflammation over the years. It's really sort of under-respected villain in the whole process, in large part because it's hard to understand. It's got very different definitions, markers of inflammation. It's hard to nail down exactly what it is. But ultimately, it's the body's response to abnormal conditions, trying to remove whatever's abnormal and make the cell normal or make the tissue normal once again. In cardiology, one of the more common markers of inflammation is called high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or hsCRP. Some of your listeners there will have that measured on you know, blood tests that they have done and so forth, and that's what that's looking at. It's looking at inflammation. Now, there are other markers. There's interleukins and cytokines and metalloproteases, but the whole point is reduce inflammation as much as possible. Reduce hypertension. Reduce smoking. Stop smoking. Reduce stress, those sorts of things, and you're less likely to be pushing pins into that balloon.
I like your definition of inflammation, but it's kind of hard to figure out. What you're saying is that the doctors do have some markers that they can predict how much inflammation is available, like you said, the highly sensitive CRP. So if somebody gets that test done, is there something you can do to fix the inflammation, or how would be someone's approach? Call up the sun and say, "Hey, what can you do for me?" I'm just curious. How does a doctor address inflammation?
So, it really depends on the context in which it's occurring, and it's really chronic inflammation that we want to reduce. Acute inflammation is if somebody twists their ankle, or again, you cut your skin. The acute inflammatory response is necessary to temporarily stabilize the area. What we don't want is what's called chronic inflammation. We don't want it day after day after day when we don't have a cut on our arm, when we don't have a twisted ankle. Because there, it's really, again, you're just pushing needles in the discussion about the cardiovascular system. You're just pushing needles into the walls of the artery, and you're basically taunting it to rupture. And so there are ways to reduce inflammation. If someone is diagnosed as having coronary artery disease and their markers of inflammation are elevated, often the treatments that are used for treating atherosclerosis, such as statins, such as eicosapentaenoic acid and others, by reducing the causes of atherosclerosis, by reducing cholesterol, by relaxing the vasculature, by reducing hypertension, those will reduce the inflammatory response. They will reduce inflammation. We can modify our diet. We can exercise. We can do stress-relieving practices like yoga or meditation, those sorts of things. They can all help to a degree. But ultimately, inflammation is really a warning. It's your body saying, hey, something's not normal. Something's going on inside that's not healthy, and I'm trying to deal with it. And so ultimately, we don't want to just treat the inflammation. We want to treat the cause of the inflammation. What's causing the body to respond in a way saying, hey, I don't have a normal cellular condition occurring here? So if we can normalize what's occurring, again, if it's energy metabolism, if our sugars are high, if our fats are too high, if it's a dietary or something we can modify with medicine, then we'll do that. And those will not only modify either the fat, the cholesterol, the sugar, but as a secondary benefit, they will also then reduce inflammation. But there are some novel therapies we'll talk about in a few minutes here that specifically go after some of those inflammatory markers, and they do seem to show some modest cardiovascular benefit. And we'll get to those in a minute.
Okay. So give me some potential new lipid modifiers, because I know you're an expert in lipids. So what's coming around the corner to make sure that those lipids aren't aggravated if they're in the vessel wall?
Well, so let's do this. Let's start with some of the ones that exist, and they're very good. Again, talking about atherosclerosis, we talked about atherosclerosis past. There's the ghost of atherosclerosis past. And in the past, big thing for addressing it was, hey, diet modification and so forth. Let's talk about some of the current treatments, and then we'll get into some of the new ones right on the heels of this. But right now, still, the best data exists with a treatment class called the statins, or HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. And what statins do, and these the brand names that people might have recognized from the past are things like Lipitor, Zocor, Crestor. These were ones, they're all generic now. So you have rosuvastatin, you have atorvastatin, simvastatin, and so forth. But what they do, they essentially reduce the amount of cholesterol that the liver would produce to make bile. And when the liver doesn't have enough cholesterol that it's making in order to then produce bile, the liver says, well, I need more cholesterol. Let me pull it out of the bloodstream, and I'll use that cholesterol to make my bile. And that has wonderful cardiovascular benefits. It turns out, when statins were created and it pulled cholesterol out of the bloodstream because it wasn't making its own and it used this backup system, well, lo and behold, instead of having cholesterol floating around the bloodstream and building up into these plaques and destabilizing the existing plaques, people were having fewer heart attacks and strokes, and they weren't dying as much. And so this was a wonderful discovery. It's actually discovered by one local guy in particular, but Mike Brown and Joe Goldstein won a Nobel Prize for their work on what's called the LDL receptor. And LDL, people will hear about that. The LDL cholesterol is the particle primarily responsible for carrying cholesterol around the body. Actually, its main responsibility is to carry fat to the cells, carry energy. But oh, by the way, this secondary passenger, which is not really helpful, that sits on that LDL particle is cholesterol. And how do we get rid of cholesterol and these LDL particles in the bloodstream? Well, it turns out it's the liver that does that. And Doctors Brown and Goldstein became famous in the 60s and early 70s. They had a famous patient, a young lady, teenager, who had very bad, what's called familial hypercholesterolemia. She had cholesterol levels about six times normal and was going to die as a youngster. And the cardiologist at the time wanted to give her a heart transplant, and Brown and Goldstein argued, no, you can't just transplant her heart. You have to transplant her liver as well. And at the time, that was completely unheard of to do that. Why would we do that? And they made the argument that there's this thing called the LDL receptor, and that's what clears atherosclerotic cholesterol out of the bloodstream. Long story short, after their arguments, the girl received a new heart and liver, and she did great for many years. Unfortunately, when she was a teenager, she stopped taking her medications for organ transplant, and she died from organ rejection because she stopped the medicines. But the proof of concept was there. They won the Nobel Prize for this LDL receptor work that they've done. And so statins enhance or upregulate LDL receptors. And the new medications we'll talk about as well, ultimately, that's what they do. They increase, think of an LDL receptor as like a broom sweeping cholesterol out of the bloodstream. And it does that in order to collect the LDL, the cholesterol, to make bile. It also explains why right after a meal, when we have this huge bolus of cholesterol floating around through the gastrointestinal system and into the bloodstream, why the LDL receptor-based therapies are less effective in postprandial times. Because when we eat a meal and our bloodstream is full of cholesterol, the liver doesn't need to sweep any more out of the bloodstream. It has all that it needs. And so unfortunately, those therapies that exist, including statins and some of the newer ones, if they are based on LDL receptor activity, that effectiveness is lessened during the postprandial or post-meal times. And that's a key weakness in those therapies. So statins are the best. If anybody's out there and they've tried a statin and have been intolerant, please try a couple different simple tips to get back on the statin. Simple things, it can be as simple as a person may not be intolerant of a statin, may actually be a hyper responder. You may only need a low dose. So go down to the lowest tolerable dose. There are studies that show vitamin D3 can help tolerance. And even if you have to take a low dose, starting with maybe once a week and then twice a week and then graduate up to where it's tolerable, the patient may not, again, be intolerant of statins. They may be a hyper responder to statin. So a very low dose may actually give a huge response in terms of lowering LDL cholesterol and arterial cholesterol levels. Diet will help. Plant sterols versus plant stanols. There are some products out there like various butters and margarines that claim to lower cholesterol, but any form of sterol, plant sterol, campesterol, desmosterol, cytosterol, any sterol can become atherosclerotic. It doesn't have to be cholesterol. But if there are products that have stanols, S-T-A-N-O-L-S, those may not be as atherogenic. There are older medications. There are bile acid sequestrants. There's niacin. There's a drug called ezetimibe, which is an intestinal blockade mechanism. It blocks cholesterol coming in from the diet. That's actually modestly helpful. There's a newer one called bempedoic acid. The brand name is Nexletol. That's actually been shown to reduce MACE events and heart attacks. So there are some good existing therapies out there. Statins are the best. It has the most data. And also what exists now, and I think, Dr. Fallon, you're a big fan, there's what's called PCSK9, proprotein convertase subtilisin kexin 9, PCSK9 modifiers. They really drop that cholesterol significantly. And what they do is they enable those LDL receptors to stay up and active all day long, even through the postprandial times, as much as possible. And you'll see tremendous drops in cholesterol. Their brand names are things like Repatha, Praluent. There's a new one out there. And Inclisiran is a newer form, or Leqvio is the brand name. And it's a little bit of a different type. It's a RNA modifier. But these newer pro-protein or PCSK9 modifiers do a great job of dropping that cholesterol. They do have very good data in terms of reducing MACE events. If a patient needs those to get their cholesterol down, really normal at this point, LDL cholesterol will be considered 100 milligrams per deciliter. With statins and with Repatha and some of the others, they'll get it down to under 70, under 55 in some cases, which is really, really very helpful for patients at risk of coronary disease and atherosclerosis. So those are some of the existing ones.
Can I just ask you one question? Can you talk about LPA, because that's getting hot? You talked about inclisiran. So what's coming around the corner for people who are genetically positive for lipoprotein small a?
Right. So that is, as you mentioned, that is really starting to get very, very hot now these days. It actually has been a big, again, sort of overlooked villain in the sense that it's not commonly tested for. There are blood tests for it, but it wasn't commonly tested because at the time there really is no good therapy for it, and that's going to change soon. So lipoprotein little a, or LP small a, is essentially it's the same protein structure, or very, very, very similar protein structure to LDL. And it functions and it carries cholesterol. It is atherogenic. It has a little bit of a longer tail on it, and so that makes it different. And unfortunately, what it does with that longer tail proteinous end on it, it actually mimics a thing called plasminogen, but it stops the conversion in the clotting process of plasminogen to plasmin. So what ends up happening is people who have high levels of lipoprotein little a end up more likely to form clots when they shouldn't be clotting. And what happens in those patients, if you have, again, like think of these little sticky balls of bubble gum floating around your body now, Well, eventually what happens is one of them is going to stick and block up an artery in the heart or an artery in the brain, and it's going to cause, again, either a heart attack or a stroke. Stroke is actually usually more common. And so lipoprotein little a has been a problem, but because there were no specific therapies for that particular molecule, and what clears it out ultimately is a receptor called the lipoprotein-like or the LDL-like receptor. It's an LRP, it's called. And so the therapies, if a patient was tested for a lipoprotein little a and was diagnosed as having high levels, the only therapy was, well, we just have to knock down your total level of cholesterol even further. So instead of getting those LDL and total cholesterol levels down below 100 or 70 or 55, try and get it down to 40 or 35 and hope that in taking the whole levels of cholesterol down and the carriers of cholesterol down, you're going to also knock down this lipoprotein little a and reduce events. But coming up now, so there's at least five different drugs, really six different therapies from five different companies to address lipoprotein A. The ones that seem closest to market right now, there's one called olpasiran from Amgen. That's an injectable drug. There's one called lepodisiran from Eli Lilly, is also an injectable. Now, Lilly has a oral pill called muvalaplin. There's other injectables coming. There's one called zerlasiran, pelacarsen, and then there's a different drug in a different class, which we'll talk about a little bit. Obicetrapib is a CETP inhibitor, but part of what that will do is also lower lipoprotein little a. But all these new drugs coming, with the exception of the obicetrapib, are specific to lipoprotein little a, and they lower it in some cases 100%. Even maybe more. They even remove some that's already existing in your body below levels that the placebo groups experienced. And Dr. Fallon, as you know as well as I, it's a very exciting time when you see these new drugs that reduce these markers of disease. But ultimately what they have to show is, okay, it's nice that you're either lowering cholesterol or in this case lowering lipoprotein little a, but ultimately are you reducing death, heart attack, and stroke? Are you reducing MACE events? Because we have seen therapies in the past that reduce markers. They reduce LDL cholesterol. They reduce triglycerides. They reduce inflammation, but they didn't reduce heart attack and stroke. And what these new drugs will have to show before they actually hit the market, and these studies are all underway now. Okay, it's wonderful. It's very exciting that they're reducing lipoprotein little a by anywhere from 67 to 100%, but is it going to translate into fewer deaths, heart attacks, and strokes? And that's going to be the key. That ultimately is going to be whether or not these drugs hit the market. So, and that's about, at this point, anywhere from 12 to 24 months away for those studies to conclude.
So, Pete, let me ask a question. Can you help the audience out? You know, who are the players who have LPA but don't know it? And who are the players who have LPA, know it, and don't realize that, say, there's a drug like inclisiran on the market? And, you know, basically, what's the family history of these people who have this LPA molecule, which is deleterious? Can you just give a little update, like, if somebody's listening, do they have LPA? Are they going to have a bunch of family members who die early? Just how would you hunt out those LPA patients? Because, like you say, we now have a product on the market that will reduce that LPA by 50, 60%.
So, yeah, the products that we have on the market are going to reduce the LDL cholesterol by 50, 60%. And to reduce the lipoprotein little a is still a difficult thing to do, and exactly for the reason you're mentioning. It's very hard to diagnose. Who is that patient? The only true diagnosis is to actually get it measured in a blood test. Unfortunately, typically that's usually not covered by insurances, and so it may cost extra to have it done. Well, why should I have it done if I don't really know I have it? Well, the one sort of set of criteria which may suggest you might be at risk is exactly what you just said, Dr. Fallon, is family history. Did you have a parent or a sibling who had especially at an early age, maybe in their 50s, did they have a stroke or a heart attack while otherwise seemingly healthy? And even if they seemingly had relatively normal cholesterol levels, did they have a heart attack or stroke? That may be an indicator of high levels of lipoprotein little A. And do they tend to clot? Do they have markers of early clotting? If for some reason they had clotting measures done, and they can't have that done as well, do they tend to clot more easily? These are the people that should be tested for lipoprotein little A. And if it's there, again, right now the only therapy is to really pound down as far as possible the total pool of cholesterol existing in the body. It may be helpful to talk to their cardiologist about possibly doing some anti-clotting therapies, maybe something as simple as aspirin every day, up to something as some of the other anti-coagulating agents that exist out there. There's people would recognize the brand names Eliquis and Pradaxa and Xarelto. Those are what's called novel oral anticoagulants, or NOACs, apixaban, dabigatran, rivaroxaban. Those may all be helpful for those patients. But until these real new therapies come out, the olpasiran, the other ones that we had mentioned, there's nothing specific directly right now, but hang in there. Again, push down the cholesterol as far as possible. Keep the inflammation down so that you don't have the alarm go off to cause clotting. One of the great things we should talk about in terms of an anti-inflammatory and anti-atherogenic treatment is omega-3s, and in specific, one that's called eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA. And you and I have spent many hours going over the benefits of eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA. That is a really helpful drug for every facet. In fact, it's the only therapy that currently exists that touches all three facets, or all three villains, in atherosclerosis. It helps to reduce levels of cholesterol. It significantly reduces inflammation and also helps to normalize clotting. It's the only drug class that does. In fact, only drug. It's the only one in its class. Statins are good for cholesterol and some of the inflammation, but don't address the clotting. The anticoagulants reduce clotting, but they don't address the cholesterol or the inflammation. Some of the newer drugs address one or two of those, but not all three. EPA, the brand name was Vascepa. It now exists as a generic eicosapentaenoic acid. Is an outstanding drug. It has outstanding data for reducing events, and specifically the EPA. I think one of the things that's become clear over time, another main omega-3 fatty acid that exists is called DHA, or docosahexaenoic acid, and that has not been shown to be nearly as effective or functional as the EPA. And I'll give you a quick, really kind of fascinating story. But if a patient can take omega-3 with a very high EPA content, or this Vascepa, which is 100%, Vascepa is the only one that's 100% pure EPA, that's most beneficial. But I'll give you a quick story as an anti-inflammatory agent and how it's helpful in every cell of the body. So omega-3s are essential fatty acid. That means every single cell in the body needs it to function, and we can't make it. It has to come from an external source. Our body can't put together little carbons and hydrogens and oxygens and form and eicosapentaenoic acid. We have to take it in. And the most common, it occurs naturally in algae, but then essentially ends up in fish. And when we eat fish, we get these omega-3 fats, and in particular EPA. So there was a patient and a physician that had come to me years ago. Patient had suffered a stroke while showering one night, and after the stroke was having seizures. And hey, was there any benefit to using EPA in a patient having seizures? And sure enough, there was data that suggested that yes, the EPA lowers the neuroelectronic thresholds that exist when patients have seizures and convulsions and so forth. The patient started the Vascepa, ended up doing extremely well, and knock wood, to this day, hasn't had seizures since. But earlier this summer, our little dog, Maisie, 16-year-old teacup beagle, we thought she had a stroke one Friday night, and we were heartbroken, especially my wife. That dog clings like Velcro to my wife, and we thought we were going to have to put her to sleep the next day on a Saturday. So we wake up Saturday morning, and Maisie's still not doing great, but she had improved a little bit. When she suffered on Friday night, she couldn't stand. Her head was lifting. Her tongue was hanging out. Saturday, she was a little bit better. We couldn't call the vet to do the euthanasia, so we couldn't do anything on that day. But as the days went by, she started to get a little bit better. And I realized that, you know, for stroke, they usually don't recover function not this quickly. Long story short, the following Friday, we're taking her outside and she goes into a full-blown seizure for about 90 seconds. And it was really painful. But I said, okay, at least I know this is not a stroke. This is a seizure. We put her on a low, very low dose of Vascepa. Dr. Fallon, wouldn't you know it, since July 19th, she has not had a single seizure. She's gotten her weight down to normal. She had this thing called Cushing's disease, which made her overeat and overdrink and urinate and so forth. She's gotten that under control. So, and she's basically gone back to normal. She's like she was 2 or 3 years ago. It's really stunning how this low dose of icosapentaenoic acid has helped her in reducing the inflammation that was occurring in her brain. And just as importantly, we took her off. She was eating almost exclusively tuna fish, high in DHA. And because she has very few teeth, we stopped the DHA from the tuna. We put an EPA in its place, and it is amazing how it has normalized her brain function and cellular function. So that's a story of one patient. It's not a clinical trial, which is really what is most helpful in science and in medicine. But not to be overlooked is the benefit of that. And so when we're talking about atherosclerosis and reducing inflammation, we can't underestimate. I think a lot of the teachings in medicine have focused on reducing cholesterol up to this point in these recent times. Exactly what you're saying. There's now more focus on treating inflammation. And that has led to sort of a renaissance in some of these newer therapies. And I think now's probably a good time, if you think, let's talk about some of them, if that's okay.
Yeah, give me 1 second. I just want to tell you about a patient I had. I had a patient who had a positive LPA, and he was diagnosed because he had a high, not males in the family, had significant strokes in like in 50, and MIs also. So we did an LPA on the patient. It was incredibly off the wall. I told him, you know, that he's got to get, you know, the Vascepa and, you know, take his statins and all that. Well, he didn't do anything. I got a call on Christmas Eve, and he just had a quadruple bypass and was told, come on back in 2 weeks and we're going to do your carotids. So I just have to tell you, if you have that LPA, what Pete is telling you, it's kind of got fixable stuff now. And you got to just, if you've got the family history of early atherosclerotic disease, get your doctor order an LPA because it can just save lives. And here we have a little dog who is actually teaching a lot of people over the air. If you have LPA, get it checked and make sure you're in the right family that'll fix it.
Yeah.
Right, sorry about that interview.
No. So, Doc, what you point out is so incredibly important. A lot of these underlying dangers are not symptomatic. It's not something where people are going to feel something. They're not going to feel bad or feel a pain or an ache that prompts them to go to their cardiologist and say, hey, listen, I've got something wrong with me. Can you check me out? It's critical when it happens to a parent, a father, a mother, a sibling. The siblings are even more telling. Sometimes the parents are carriers of some genetic issues that don't express themselves in the parents, but it expresses in the children. And so if you have a brother or sister that has had an event, you should get yourself checked right away. If these things are genetic, it's really most telling in siblings. So exactly what you're and in the case of lipoprotein little a, clotting, which usually almost always manifests as a stroke before it manifests as a heart attack. So yes, those are the patients, and that family history is so critical. I wish it was covered by insurance. I wish it was cheap and easy to do for all of us. Again, it's so hidden because we just don't look for it. Why don't we look for it? Well, it's an expensive test, so we just don't do it that normally. But it's out there. It's out there, and it's probably existent. The numbers now are anywhere from 10 to 20% of the patients out there have elevated LP little a, and basically none of us know it. You're exactly right.
So, Pete, that's why you're on Inside Medicine. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just move on a little bit, Pete, because I know you've got so many things that you can cover. And I just wanted to ask you about, you talked about EPA. Are all EPA products the same? And are we going to lose out because the Supreme Court didn't hear the main LPA company's request for what it could do for cardiovascular benefits in American patients?
So the quick answer is yes, we are going to lose out. And one thing that you and I have talked about over the years is just how useful in so many various disease states is this eicosapentaenoic acid, because again, it's in every cell of the body, hair, eyes, skin, bone, kidney, heart, everywhere. And so when it's not at normal levels, those tissues and organs can often not function properly. And so it's not all fish oil products are the same. In fact, most of what we buy in the supermarket or at the stores is really just the sweepings off the factory floor. And the company has paid to catch the fish and to process it into these fertilizers and foods and other things. And oh, by the way, we have this oil just laying around. We'll bottle that up and we'll sell that as quote unquote healthy fish oil. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the case. It's really the EPA. If somebody wants to take EPA and they qualify, they can have it prescribed by their cardiologist or by their physician. But if they don't meet the recommendations medically and they want to just buy it at a store, what you really have to look for, look on the back of the bottle. It'll tell you there the amounts of EPA versus DHA versus maybe DPA or other omega-3s that are in there. You need to look for as high a possible level of EPA. One of the highest ones that I would know of might be a Carlson's. It's called Max EPA, M-A-X-E-P-A. That's of all the sort of store-bought, I think that's even online. I don't know if that's in health food stores. That's one of the highest EPA levels if they can't get the prescription. The prescription is the best, 100% pure. That's the best way to go. But there are other drugs coming out as well. There's other lipid modifiers that are coming. There's a new one I had briefly mentioned called obicetrapib. It's in a class of what's called a cholesterol ester transfer protein inhibitor, or a CETP inhibitor. It's going to drop the LDL, the bad cholesterol, about 43%. It drops the 43 to 51%, very high levels of LPA reductions. It drops lipoprotein little a almost 50%. It raises the good cholesterol, HDL, about 142%. It's still not out to market. It's in development. It's actually undergoing those MACE studies. Hey, Pete, that's great. Obicetrapib, this CETP inhibitor, is got these. It's great data for the markers, but does it reduce MACE events? Well, we'll have to see. It's undergoing MACE studies right now. There are new drugs coming out for reducing super high levels of triglycerides, what's called hypochylomicronemia. There's one called olezarsen. There's others, plozasiran is another one coming out. They reduce super high levels of triglycerides up to like 80%. And that reduces a condition called acute pancreatitis. When the triglyceride levels are way too high, it can damage the pancreas. So there are new therapies coming there. Anti-inflammatory therapies, there's one that's out there already. It's an older drug called colchicine. But it's been reformulated at a very low dose to have cardiovascular benefits. It's got actually some pretty good data, primarily reduces MI and other MACE events. But
I think that was just approved by the FDA a few months ago.
That is correct. Yeah, very recently approved for use. It's initially was existing as a therapy for gout. But they found that, hey, that it reduces inflammation. It stabilizes those plaques that we had talked about. There are drugs out there, often autoimmune drugs, but there are therapies that exist for other disease conditions. But when they reduce inflammation systemically for other parts of the body, for skin disease, for joint disease, oh, hey, by the way, it's also reducing cardiovascular inflammation and stabilizing plaques. And, hey, we found that these patients, when they're on these other anti-inflammatory therapies, they tend to have fewer heart attacks and strokes and deaths. So colchicine was reformulated to do that. It's a brand name now called Lodoco, L-O-D-O-C-O, low-dose colchicine. There are new drugs. There's a bunch of new drugs coming out there. Ultimately, they're all going to do that. There's drugs out there now for fatty liver, which have evolved. These have evolved from cholesterol therapies, atherosclerotic therapies. So, we have to maybe talk again about these diabetic drugs, the GLP-1 and 2s and the SGLT-2s. They also have cardiovascular benefit. And then the weight loss that they cause will also be helpful for reducing events. Not in the same way, not necessarily a thrombotic event, But we started this conversation talking about different forms of cardiovascular disease. And so those drugs like Wegovy and Mounjaro, they are showing cardiovascular benefit from their weight loss. So we've talked already here about atherosclerosis, past, present, and now some of these future therapies. There's so much going on. These are all so helpful because, folks, we don't have to have atherosclerosis end our life soon or reduce the quality of our life. And even if we have a heart attack or stroke, if we are taking some of these therapies and doing some of these modifiable behaviors, there'll be less damage from that heart attack. There'll be more survivable, more recoverable events.
Okay, so Pete, I think I'll stop there. Thank you. Pete, I got to thank you very much. You did a phenomenal job. That's Peter Bentadagna. I got to say, incredibly knowledgeable. Helped us out. Pete, we're going to have to get you back. You had a few opening lines that you have to finish up. So Inside Medicine will be back. His podcast will be up hopefully in about 1 hour or less. Pete, thank you very much for helping out Inside Medicine again. And I'm going to definitely ask you to come back.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fallon.